Did we discuss last week how Dwarka is more important than the heavenly planets? Did we? Yeah, I thought we did, yeah. And we had a look at the a Vedic reception from both sides of both points of view, that of the the person being received or persons being received and those who are receiving the guest. We discussed all the homework questions all the way through chapter 10 and 11, except these ones dealing with the queens of Dwarka. So, what we're going to do is explain with reference to verses chapter 10, 28 to 30. And chapter 11, 30 to 39, the relationship between Krishna and his queens in Dwarka. And while doing that, we get a clear understanding so that we can defeat a lot of the major misunderstandings that people have about Krishna, especially this one, that Krishna is immoral or lusty. You know, which is, of course, tends to substantiate for people that Krishna is somehow an ordinary human being, because ordinary human beings are lusty and immoral, and therefore they reflect upon his pastimes as being lusty and immoral, and that confirms to them, yes, that Krishna is actually a material personality, maybe, you know, a powerful demigod or something like that, but still part of the material existence. And even accepting that Krishna is someone great, they tend to feel that Krishna's immoral or lusty stance somehow supports their immoral and lusty activities. So we really need to defeat that misunderstanding by properly understanding the relationship between Krishna and his queens in Dwarka. Naturally, you know, pointing out its transcendental nature and having a look at that. And of course, this having done this section today, then you should be able to very easily answer the open book assessment question 2, which asks exactly that same question. So, first of all, one of the homework questions is to describe the two classes of devotees of the Lord in the stage of conjugal love. So we can understand, of course, that the queens of Dwarka have a relationship with the Lord as his wives, and therefore a conjugal relationship. They're not friends, they're not servants, although that's included within conjugal. They're all that plus, you know, they love the Lord as his wives. And there are two types of conjugal lovers of the Lord. Let's have a look at that. In relationship to the purport of text 28, chapter 10. Alright, a couple of Sanskrit terms. What have we got? Swakya. That's and Alright. So, two classes. Now, let's have a little bit more information. Alright, let's say, who are the prominent conjugal lovers that fit into either of these categories? Swakia?
The queens.
Yeah. And the gopis, Parakeya. Okay. So, therefore, the queens are
married.
They're married lovers of the Lord, and the gopis are they unmarried? How do we say they're unmarried? The damsels of the Braja, the queens of Dwarka were Swakya, or duly married wives, but the damsels of the Braja were young friends of the Lord while he was unmarried. He's unmarried, but it's not necessarily that they were all unmarried. But they're in the they're in the mood of girlfriends. Paramour. So some of the gopis are married and some of them are unmarried. Some are married, some are unmarried. As Prabhupada puts it here, is a young friends of the Lord while he was unmarried. So it tends to, you know, make them paramour, sort of. Hope that's the right spelling. They have that mood. The Lord stayed at Vrindavan to the age of 16, and his family relations with the neighbouring girls were in terms of Parakeya. I think Krishna left when he was about 11-ish. Yeah. But the Acharyas have analysed the different stages of Krishna's years in Vrindavan. They're grouped into those ages, you know, so when he was about 11, it was sort of, from about comparable to a 16-year-old, his mood, his activities. So we say, you know, his form, you know, appeared slightly different. As we know, he in his pastimes, he takes the form of a young baby, and gradually, chubby little boy, and gradually his form develops into features which are very attractive to the gopis in a conjugal mood. So that verse there, Text number 28 appears to be glorifying the queens of Dwarka. In actuality, it ends up glorifying the gopis. It's describing the mood of love and the intimate relationship that the queens of Dwarka have gained, being so qualified in piety, and then it just describes that the position of the Brajabhumi gopis was even greater than that. Their love was so intense that just at the thought of these activities, just the thought of relishing the nectar from Krishna's lips would make them faint. So it's describing how their mood of love was actually more intense and sweeter. yep.
At the time he said that he's already married to the queen, you know, so. So when did he get married to the queen? Much before.
Krishna married the queens when he killed Bhumasura. Krishna first married Rukmini, he married then another seven wives.
So how old was
he? He took Rukmini back to Dwarka.
And then he married
the queen. He was already living in Dwarka when he married the queens, the 16,108 queens.
So what was his age at the time?
16. Right, yeah. Another sense. I don't know that there is such I haven't seen an age put to that. We know that Krishna was about 11-ish when he left Vrindavan. Went to Mathura, stayed there for some time, not a long time, killed Kamsa. That happened reasonably quickly. There was some battle with different demons. Krishna transferred all the residents of Mathura to Dwarka. And then from there he also then married Rukmini and the other seven wives and then the 16,108 queens.
It's not in chronological order.
Well,
because it said that, when he left for.
Oh, well,
Dwarka, he already had the queens.
When he, what's that?
When he left for Vrindavan and he's going to Dwarka, he already had the queens, waiting for him.
So when he left.
When he was going to Dwarka.
Here. Oh, yes, we're talking about. Because he's gone to Hastinapur. Oh, at this age. Oh, at this age, he's probably 125 or something. He's. At this age. Oh yeah, this is right at the end.
I was thinking at the age of 16.
I thought you meant, at what age did he marry? at this age here, yes, it's right at the end of his pastimes, because the Battle of Kurukshetra. Mm-hmm. shortly after these pastimes, at this stage, if memory serves me correctly, Krishna's already wound up his Vrindavan pastimes. At some stage here, on his way, you know, he visited Vrindavan and wound up those pastimes. He goes back to Dwarka, and then after some time winds up his Dwarka pastimes. This is described in the 11th canto. So he's at the very end of his pastimes in this section that we're reading here. We'll see, you know, within the next few chapters, how the Pandavas retire after hearing that Krishna has left the planet. That's coming up in the next few chapters. So, you know, we're right on the point where Krishna is leaving the planet. It describes a little bit in the third canto about Krishna actually leaving. So, we hear about the Pandavas soon, you know, retiring, going back to the spiritual world, because Krishna left the planet and all the Dwarka pastimes have been wound up. And then that subject is a little bit more detail is given in the third canto, and then it's given in more detail in the 11th canto. Okay. Looking again a little bit more at the. So that answers that question. So let me hear someone say it, put it in words. Describe the two classes of devotees of the Lord in the stage of conjugal love. So, Nanda. One sentence describes the Svakya. In a sentence, answer what are the Svakya conjugal devotees of the Lord? Describe that relationship with an example.
It's like the queens of Dwarka.
Yep.
They married Krishna.
Yep.
And conjugal
person. Yep. Yep. And from the ladies, who could say, similarly, what is parakeya conjugal rasa?
The sense of Krishna,
mm-hmm.
and yet they're in a paramour relationship with Krishna.
While he was unmarried.
While he wasn't married,
yeah.
And they married when he was
married. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. So that's the answer there. So now we want to look into the relationship a little bit more between Krishna and his queens of Dwarka, now that we know that they're in this division here. Alright, sticking with text number 28, what else can we see? Something either about Krishna or about the queens that somehow describes or illuminates the relationship. Yes.
They were all transcendental, having engaged in many lifetimes of sacrifice.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's a good point that, for instance, we can't say that they're the result of lust because they're the result of piety or control of the mind and senses over many lifetimes. Mm. Yeah. So that's a good point. So. The relationship is, you know, the reward or the result of piety, millions of lifetimes. So yes, that's a good point. Yeah. Is there a statement there?
Yeah.
Is it? Read it out.
They are all means to attain the highest stage of Sarupa to render constitutional practice of service to the Lord. Each and every living being has its individual position in one of the above mentioned five different kinds of reciprocating means with the Lord.
Right.
And in one pure spiritual form of Sarupa, the relation becomes manifest without mundane affinity.
Yes. Yep. Yep. So, there's no mundane affinity. And this is from the perspective of the queens. It's their svarup. Eternal constitutional spiritual position. Because eternal means spiritual. It has to be spiritual. If we say use the word eternal, it has to be spiritual. No mundane affinity. It's a sarup. It's an eternal spiritual constitution. Yes. So that's from the queen's side. Another way to verify that it's not mundane. Yeah, so you have great sages, you know, lifelong brahmacharis like Sukadeva, who, you know, affirm that, you know, and Lord Chaitanya, they affirm the above. We're talking about spiritual relationships, not mundane subjects. The relationship is a topic of a spiritual subject. Now, what about from Krishna's point of view? Anything there? Yep. Yeah.
Krishna takes these rules to satisfy the.
Yeah. So, from Krishna's point, it's also spiritual because he has no hankering. We can't, for someone who has no hankering, we certainly can't say that he's lusty. He's satisfying his devotees. You know, loving mood. Can't say that's lusty. What about from verse 29? We see from verse 29 that it describes the children of these ladies, of Pajumna, Samba, Amber, etc., ladies like Rukmini, Satyabhama, Jambavati, were forced to be taken away by him from their Svayamvara ceremonies after he defeated many powerful kings, headed by Sishupal, and other ladies were also forcibly taken away by him after he killed Bhomasura and thousands of his assistants. All of these ladies are glorious. We see in the purport then, of course, if we know the story, that these girls prayed piteously to Lord Krishna for their deliverance, and the merciful Lord, called by their fervent prayer, release them all by fighting and killing Bhaumasura. All these captive princesses were then accepted by the Lord as his wives. Right, the all-powerful Lord of Krishna accepted the humble prayers of these girls and married them with the adoration of queens. So Krishna had no hankering. He was satisfying the devotees' loving mood. And here we also see that the relationships never manifested out of his love, but they actually prayed. They prayed to the Lord for him to be their husband, and he satisfied that. So that confirms that previous statement. We see that even in the Svayamvara, of the various wives, such as Rukmini, one may say, oh, but he forcibly stole Rukmini away. But Rukmini asked him to. Can you please come and... Yeah. The sages of Dandakaranya?
Yeah.
As far as I understand, they ended up as gopis.
I think I read that in the past, these princesses who were captured by Bhaumasura were actually the sages of the Dandakaranya one, and they prayed to Lord Ram to be their master. But he said in that, as Lord Ram was going to another pilgrimage, he only had one wife. But when he moved to take the next, he didn't take the same condition as Lord Krishna, he wanted to satisfy them as their
Yes, I thought those Dandakaranya sages ended up as gopis, groups.
Yes,
not as queens.
So some of the queens ended up being gopis from the end
So that's possible. The sages have done the Karanya. I think it's in the Nectar Devotion and some other scriptures as well. And they did end up as certain groups. There are many different groups of gopis, of which they were some. Yeah. What's that? There's Municharis. Dandakaranya became the Munichari gopis, and then you have the Shrutichari gopis, who were the Vedas personified. Yeah, so they ended up as gopis, that's right. Yeah. Alright, looking at text number 30, can we see anything there? So so far we've established that it's transcendental, both from the part of the queens, it's their original swarup, resulting out of piety, not impiety. It's affirmed by great stalwart acharyas like Sukadeva Goswami, Lord Chaitanya, and from Krishna's side, he's reciprocating to their prayers. And their natural mood of love, and he personally has no hankering, he's satisfying his devotees. So we've established it as transcendental on both sides. What do we see from text number 30? Is that in? Yeah, can you read? Is that from text 30? Read.
There's no bodily disqualification of the body, just as there's no qualitative difference between the Ganges water and the unfiltered drink water when they are annihilated.
Okay, so it's that's sort of confirming that it's, you know, a relationship not on the bodily platform, you know. Yeah, yeah. There's no material disqualification, qualification or disqualification. There's no material considerations. It's all enacted on a platform of spiritual love. Now, just before I comment on what you said, Bishka, that seems to answer the next question. Explain why the Lord accepted the fallen girls under the clutches of Banasura as his wives. What you said would be a good answer to that. That the fallen girls under the clutches of Banasura sincerely prayed to Lord Krishna for their deliverance, and their sincerity of purpose made them at once pure by virtue of devotion. So, why the Lord accepted fallen girls? Because they were no longer fallen, they were purified by the sincerity of their purpose. But from text 30 we also see, as far as their relationship, that their husband, Krishna, never left them alone at home. He always pleased their hearts by making valuable presentations. So, you know, here we see that Krishna has no personal hankerings. He accepted them as his wives, not out of lust, but to satisfy their loving mood. And we can see that he did that completely. You know, from text 30, that he completely satisfied them as a husband. So that is, that's an important part of the relationship. From Krishna completely satisfied them in that relationship. He fully played the part of a loving husband. This is very difficult for people to understand, especially non-devotees. In fact, non-devotees can't understand it at all. Krishna has nothing to gain personally, and yet he is, out of love, he is fully reciprocating, as, you know, perfectly, as far as anyone could possibly imagine, to their full satisfaction. And yet he has nothing, no hankering and nothing to gain. Generally in this world, people can only understand that they will commit themselves to anything for some particular gain. And therefore it's very hard to understand Krishna's motives. So they must think, oh, he must be lusty, he must be this. But Krishna has nothing to gain, no purpose to fulfill, and yet he is fully committed. So, you know, it appears contradictory. People can only find a material reason. They can't understand spiritual subject matters. That on the spiritual platform there is varieties of love on the spiritual platform, and that is the motivation. Prema is the motivation for all activities on the spiritual platform. Yeah.
Yep.
Thank
but
you.
At the same time, it's a sort of question. That,
yeah.
Krishna extended himself in so many living entities.
Yeah.
And that each of us has a special relationship with him.
Yeah.
And that relationship he desires to have restored because given that we're self-satisfied, he also enjoys. So there is something that we satisfy in him. And therefore there is something that we gain.
Well, he has nothing to gain from us, because whatever he requires, he can manifest without our help. So to include us as Nitya Siddha devotees in his eternal pastimes is only for our gain. To increase his happiness, so which is your point, but he can do that without us. So your question is saying, why did he make us? To increase his happiness, but he can do that without us. That's the point. Therefore, he's nothing to gain.
You know, when you love someone,
yeah,
and you see them happy, you are more happy. So when we are undifferentiated from him, because he's concentrating bliss, he doesn't have to be, he doesn't need us to be happy, but we need to be separated from him and have that relationship to be more happy. So when we are more happy, he's naturally also more happy.
Yes, Krishna certainly takes pleasure seeing his parts and parcels happy and reciprocating with the various expansions of his spiritual energy.
Yes, for example, if we see someone who is happy, we are naturally more happy. Mm. We are happy and satisfied, but if someone is more happy, then...
These relationships are eternal. Krishna's energies are eternal. Krishna's pastimes are eternal. Nitya Lila. So the happiness is already there. The only difference is that we have forgotten that happiness, and then we again remember that happiness. But Krishna is eternally enjoying those relationships are eternally there. So in other words, if we say that, for instance, a devotee goes back to Godhead and takes up one of the relationships with Krishna, and Krishna becomes very happy seeing that devotee happy in the spiritual world. So it's almost like he's gained another devotee who's happy, and that's increased. But that there's no real gain of another devotee. That devotee and that relationship is already there. For a brief moment in the course of eternity, spirit soul forgets. Although you can spend millions and millions and millions of lifetimes in the material world, in the span of eternity, Krishna is in that space of time in the spiritual world, a devotee has spent billions and billions of lifetimes in the material world. compared to eternity, just like that, it means very little. And for Krishna's perspective, that relationship is already there with that devotee.
I didn't understand.
Yes.
He's perfectly satisfied with But yet we're still here. So if, are we here because she must have been there? Never mind.
No, sorry.
But she must have been learning points of view, she doesn't describe more Krishna's experiences in happiness, enjoyment, or, you know, we're constantly told. Satisfied is when around you, we're not satisfied, and then we hear satisfied is when around you only, and then, you know, yellow everything.
Yes, well, Krishna's pastimes with Radharani, you know, have an unlimited variety, and they don't manifest in a void. You know, Krishna's pastimes with Radharani, surrounded by unlimited devotees that all contribute to that pastime in one way or another. That's why Krishna's pastimes with Radharani is so special, because Radharani is the full manifestation of Krishna's pastimes. Therefore, you know, when Krishna's with Radharani, it means that, you know, all the spiritual creation basically is supporting that pastime with unlimited variety. Yeah. There is a little book called Our Original Position. Have you seen that? GBC, yeah. A lot of the different quotes, you know, important quotes by Srila Prabhupada on the topic that we do originally have an eternal relationship with Krishna. So some consider there are two schools of thought amongst Vaishnavas. Some consider that we fell from the Brahma Jyoti, and others consider that we have an eternal relationship with Krishna. And Prabhupada favours the position that we all have an eternal relationship with Krishna. And many of the statements that centre around that from Shastra and from Prabhupada's lectures and what have you in that little book, Our Original Position. But offhand, I can't think of a quote which, you know, definitely just gives that analogy that, you know, within our span of life in the material world, there are statements, but I can't remember exactly where they're from. You know, it's been compared to, in one sense, waking up from a dream. That'd probably be the best place to look. Have you read that book? Anyone read that book? Did you?
Right, yeah.
That'd be the place, you know, that's the first place I'd look, because the whole topic is about that. But if I come across an exact quote, I'll certainly mention it to you. Exact reference.
Again, when shall I become your servant again? So it is explained again why he is to use the word again when he was not the servant originally.
Yes.
So like that, one statement there.
But we know that in the spiritual world, time time is conspicuous by its absence. You know, they don't operate in terms of past, present, and future. the past times rotate. And simultaneously they're eternally present. Just like you know, if we look at the time now, what is that? 3:25. So 3:25. There is always 3:25 somewhere. Somewhere, you know, it is always 3:25. And when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan in 1977, he was giving a lecture on the seventh canto, and he had a watch given to him by Guru Kripa. And he said, "Oh, you know, he gave me a nice watch," and everyone sort of laughed. And he said, "No, no, no, it's a really good watch, because you can look at it and it tells you the time in different places around the world." So he was saying, so therefore, you know, all these different times exist simultaneously. So, you know, we're saying it's 3:25, but we could also say it's 5:06, you know, and we can also say it's 7:08, and, you know, 3 minutes past midnight, because all these times are actually existing simultaneously. So Krishna's pastimes of the spiritual world rotate without past, present, and future, but at the same time they all exist simultaneously, you know, in one way or another. It's nitya lila, it's eternal, they're eternal. Same with these pastimes in the material world. We know, you know, we tend to think of it in terms of the sun rising. It's a very sequential sort of a, you know, movement of the sun. but in another sense, we can just take it that the sun is always rising. You know? And similarly, you know, we may think that in this universe, Krishna may perform his pastime of birth, Janmashtami, and then that, you know, is played out, and then it takes Janmashtami, takes, you know, that pastime goes in another universe. So it's almost like it finishes, starts, but it's not quite like that. It's eternally existing in the material world, in the same as, you know. And so Krishna's pastimes, they're a little difficult to understand completely from a mundane point of view. That they're eternally existing, at the same time they are, you know, rotating. The relationships that we have with Krishna are eternal, and eternally existing. Krishna's pastimes are existing, you know, eternally, which means that all those pastimes are made up of Krishna and his devotees. They're eternally existing. Somewhere amongst all of that is our pastime of Krishna, our eternal pastime of Krishna. You know, pastime. You know, Krishna's pastimes mean Krishna and his devotees. So, you know, we have an eternal relationship with Krishna. Somewhere there's that eternal pastime which is existing. So it doesn't cease to exist. You know. So, you know, from a material perspective, it's a little hard to grasp, you know, the fact of, you know, material world that billions and billions of years. It seems like a huge disruption to Krishna's pastimes, but they're nitya, you know, they can't, you know, from sadhana siddha, you again become nitya siddha. You know, After perfecting devotional service and becoming a sadhana siddha, one then again becomes nitya siddha. One again develops their eternal relationship with Krishna. And that eternal relationship with Krishna, there is eternal pastimes, which is existing.
How does one, like, in a sense, describe time in the spiritual world? Because it's certainly not linear.
Well, we'd call it eternal time. And, you know, without the inevities of past, present, and future. And you know, it's eternally present. You know, in the spiritual world, time, you know, is an eternal presence. You know, past and future. You know, there's nothing to mark. In one sense, the past and the future, like, you know, there's no growing old or taking birth or dying or, you know, things ceasing to exist or, you know. Yes, yeah, yeah, there's variety. Yes, yeah. The variety is that Krishna has his Astakaliya Leela, the eightfold pastimes that you know, in the morning Krishna will wake with Srimati Radharani, and then they will go back to different places where they reside, and Krishna will do different things with his parents and different devotees there, and Radharani will do things, and then they'll look forward to meeting. And gradually, Krishna will come out with his cowherd boys, and they'll perform so many different pastimes. And there'll be some signal giving to Radharani where there may be some meeting. And then they will come together. Krishna will sneak off from his cowherd boys, and they will meet together. And they will have all sorts of pastimes, as jhulanyacha, swing pastime, and water pastimes, and forest pastimes, and holly pastimes, you know, and lunch. And then Krishna will go back with his cowherd boyfriends, and there will be other pastimes, and they will all go home. And then they will go and see Mother Yasoda, and Radharani will that, and then Krishna will have his meals, which Radharani, you know, sending some things that she's cooked, and then gradually Krishna will sneak away and perform night pastimes, which again, there's water pastimes and some like this. So there's an eightfold lila, Astakaliya Leela, and that's eternal. And within that eightfold pastime, you know, they go to different forests and different places, which are all eternal. So, you know, there is unlimited variety. Plus, the very nature of the spiritual world is ever fresh. That you know, we've heard that Radharani never cooks the same preparation for Krishna twice. Whenever they meet, it's like the first time, because the nature of spiritual life is so dynamic and so tasty. You know, in the material world, of course, when we it's the law of diminishing returns. We call it the law of diminishing returns of happiness and the thrill. They have songs about that, you know. Life goes on after the thrill is gone. And, there's one singer, I forget his name. He's always singing songs, a very famous singer, about you know, his love life as a teenager. Of course, gradually, as you see the singer's career, he gets to be, you know, 50, 60 years old. He's still singing the same songs and writing the same songs. And one of his songs is, you know, Life Goes On After the Thrill Is Gone, because he's still living, you know, with the jukebox and, you know, the girlfriend and this and that and the other. But now he's 50 years old. It's all, none of that's there. So as the law of diminishing returns, but in the spiritual world it's not like that. It's actually increasing. So they meet, and it is so, thrilling and just tasty and relishable in so many different ways that it's just like the first time. You know, that it's that sense of enjoyment, and you know. So so therefore, we have eightfold pastimes that manifest eternally, which are ever fresh and increasing, you know, in happiness. There's unlimited variety, and unlimited paraphernalia. You know, here, you know, if you want to do something, you get a bit of paraphernalia. You get your car, you get your clothes, you get a little bit of money. According to, you know, what resources you've got, you go out and try and enjoy, have a picnic. In the spiritual world, there's billions and billions of devotees who are going to help Krishna that day to enjoy. Billions of devotees. And they've all got so much paraphernalia to, you know, offer Krishna. And it's not second hand, you know, it's all new and fresh garments, fresh this, fresh food, fresh everything. So, you know, the variety is, there's unlimited scope for enjoyment, variety, and it's eternal. So we say it's eternal, but it's not the same thing every day, and at the same time, it is the same thing every day. In other words, you know, Radharani is always, you know, the topmost love for Krishna. It's not like, you know, a month later, you know, it's someone else. Therefore we hear that, you know, in Krishna's rasa dance, that even though there were billions and billions of gopis, but if Radharani wasn't there, Krishna wouldn't be interested. But because Radharani is there, then, everything is special and wonderful. Radharani. Radharani is Krishna's. She is particularly compassionate. You know, of Krishna and Radharani, Krishna's compassion is unlimited, and Radharani is known to be more compassionate than Krishna.
Then,
I'll just answer. She did put her hand up. That's already a good sign.
Yeah. And the time when it touches the three gunas,
yeah.
it gets transformed in past, present, and future. With the tamoguna, when it touches,
yes,
the guna, it transforms yeah, in the past time, and then future and present is,
yeah,
the goodness. And it says the effect of the time in mode of goodness, that means past.
Mm.
Aging, for example,
Tama is past.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tama is past.
Yeah.
And Rajas is
future.
Future.
Yeah.
So if from this, for example, gross body gets manifested like aging.
Mm.
That's why the demigods, because they are not in mode of goodness,
mm,
they don't age so quickly. Mm. But those in mode of ignorance, they grow old faster.
Yes.
And there is another subtle aspect, the time in the with the mode of ignorance creates lamentation in the subtle way, and in with the mode of passion creates fear for the future.
Mm.
What's going to happen to me? I have to think about this, I have to think about that.
Yes.
And presence is different. And in spiritual world, we don't have aging because there is no mode of...
There's no mode of material nature.
And you don't have lamentation and you don't have fear, yeah, from future because, yeah, you don't have the goodness.
That's right. Time activates the modes of material nature, and therefore we have past, present, and future. Yeah. And because there's no modes of materialization in the spiritual world, then time does not manifest as past, present, and future.
That's why it says Brahma, Buddha, Prasanatma, Ashochanti, Nakanshati, you don't desire anything for the future, you're not afraid you're going to lose it, or, and you're not lamenting for the past.
That's right. Yep.
So which one is present
then? Goodness. Goodness. Maintenance.
Present is future.
Yeah. Creation. Because we're a bit silly.
Why did we fall down? We were serving Krishna, then why did suddenly we get so envious of Krishna? Because we are, if that is giving us so much of pleasure.
It's probably easy to ask how did we fall down, because we misused that the opportunity we had, you know. We misused our independence. And therefore we fell. I mean, it's not difficult to see, you know, why, you know, if you say, why did someone fall? That's not difficult. We see, for instance, let's take, who's that famous golfer? Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods. He's got the whole world at his feet. He's got, you know, everything. Why would he fall from that position?
Yeah.
So therefore we can see, you know.
If you have a spiritual world there, no question of material contamination, yet talking about falling down in the material. And Krishna, he in fact promises that once you go back to spiritual world, you will not fall down. Krishna is promising that. And you have fallen down from the spiritual world.
Krishna does promise that, but you can force his hand. That's not out of the question.
Don't we get materially exhausted when we don't want to ever come back here?
Yeah.
So when we go back to the spiritual world, we know that we never want to go back to the material.
Yeah. It's a bad, waking up from a bad dream. Just like you've all heard the statement that you know, one who becomes a devotee never takes a human birth again. They never takes an animal birth. They're guaranteed a human birth. You know, everyone's heard that. But you can force Krishna's hand. And obviously, Bharat Maharaj became a deer, and many of the different monkeys and what have you in Vrindavan are devotees of Krishna, who are attached to Krishna, and who have, because they became mischievous, wanting to commit sinful activity, you know, on the strength of being a devotee, which is the seventh offence, in order so that they don't create huge havoc and amass, you know, just having that mentality. He puts them in the form of an animal because you can't actually. You can't wreak much havoc as an animal. It almost stops your mischievous act. You can do a little bit, but not much. Whereas a human being, an offensive human who's a devotee, running around the holy dharma and, you know, all sorts of stuff, can wreak unlimited havoc to society. But a monkey causing a little bit of mischief doesn't do a lot. So Krishna puts one in the form of an animal, even though one was a human being. So the guarantee is there by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita that one who takes up the process of devotional service, you know, even a little advancement on this path will protect one from the greatest fear, the greatest danger, which is, again, taking birth in the, you know, lower species of life. So Krishna is promising there that even a little advancement will protect one. But if someone takes advantage of that, then they will, even as a devotee, take birth in the animal species of life. So it's the same. Krishna says, you know, once returning to the spiritual world, you never return again. So that's, you know, the natural, that's Krishna's promise. But It's not out of the question for a devotee to actually force Krishna's hand. And of course, you know, therefore, when someone, if Krishna does everything within his power to get us back to the spiritual world and to keep us there, and we force his hand, we can't blame Krishna. And it's, oh, you said here, you know, you said this, and you said that. You know, a bit like, you know, the Battle of Kurukshetra. You know, Krishna did everything he could to stop the war, and still Duryodhana said basically the war was all Krishna's fault. Krishna was behind the whole thing. And Krishna tried his, and in essence Krishna was. So therefore Duryodhana forced his hand. So in one sense we can blame, we can say, yes, oh Krishna, you said, you know, we won't take birth as again in the animal species, you know, we'll be protected from that sort of fear, even by a little advancement, and yet we see so many devotees that happens to. So, you know, it's we can't trick Krishna, we can't cheat Krishna, but it's just so unlikely. You know, with Krishna, you know, after going through the material world, getting back to the spiritual world, that purification and that process is so unlikely that anyone would ever go through that again. You know, therefore Krishna, you know, can promise. But if one tries to, one can certainly force Krishna's hand on that if they want. And we see Jaya and Vijaya, of course, you know, were in the spiritual world. No, it's usually a lot more serious than that. No. It's repeated offences. You know, repeat. It's more someone who's in quite an offensive mentality that I will do whatever nonsense I want, and because I'm Krishna's devotee, it'll all be just, you know, burned up. It's like that. There's a whole mentality. It's not like just a moment of hunger and what have you. No, there's no, not like that.
I had no hope.
Yeah. So Krishna fully satisfy them as a loving husband. And therefore someone asked me the question, if we're fully satisfied in the spiritual world, how do we fall down? Who started that? Ah. Yes.
One more question, a little bit off the time. Quick. In the spiritual world also we can make Vaishnava brothers,
In the spiritual world?
Because we're dealing with
our devotees. The residents of the spiritual world don't make apparat.
Knowing.
No, not at all. No.
Jaya
and Vijaya is a big topic, and we will cover that. Third canto? Yeah. We will cover that. Can you car park that for about a year? But, you know, the short answer is no. They don't create offences in the spiritual world to each other. No. Not accidentally or any other way. They know that they don't do anything which would displease Krishna or Narayana. No, because they actually love him. It's because of our lack of love that we create offences. You know, when you know, as Lord Shiva said, that the highest worship is worship of the Lord, but even higher than that is worship of his devotees. And that's understood by, you know, those devotees in the spiritual world. Because they actually love the Lord, they don't create offences because they know it would disturb him, you know, his happiness. It would never happen. But we do it because we don't have love for the Lord. And therefore, you see, even, you know, here, the Kanishta Adhikaris will create the most offences, and those offences clear to a significant degree amongst the Majjhima Adhikaris, and the Uttama Adhikaris are offenseless. What to speak of in the spiritual world. And that's based upon their degree of love. Looking at chapter 11 now, from text 30. Let's continue to look at... I might rub this off, or will I just... Is there a button you push here or something? No. Not even on. I'll rub this off. This is our 21st century board rubber, isn't it? I don't know if that's working. Do you? Yeah. No. Maybe. I don't know. Who's the expert on rubber meeting? Yeah. There's a whole science. Yeah. Just because of the method, it'll affect my... I'll end up sneezing and... I'm quite sensitive to that sort of thing. It's all right when we go out the room. Yeah. That's probably the way to do it, though.
Do you need the flip chart?
No, it's okay. Is that all right to do that?
Yeah.
Are we writing with him? Yeah. Okay. What do they usually use? Do they have a little bit of water? And that'll do it? A little bit of water. Have something to dig there. Let's move into the 21st century. What do we see from verse 30? Thereafter the Lord entered his palaces, which were perfect to the fullest extent. His wives lived in them, and they numbered over 16,000. What do we see from text 31? And text 30 to also to some degree. Text 30, actually. Yeah. What's that?
The Lord is full of opulences. Full in all opulences and unlimited.
Yeah. How does that affect your relationship? Yes, it does show that he's full in himself. I took it the other way, that it means that in the relationship he can unlimitedly satisfy the queens, So I guess you can take it both ways. It does show that he's full in himself. That describes, that's someone's relationship. We see Prabhupada says here in the purport, Lord Krishna has 16,108 wives, and for each of them, every one of them, there was a fully equipped palace, complete with necessary compounds and gardens, everything being unlimited, sama kaman, or full with all desirable equipment. So the Lord entered his palaces, which were perfect to the fullest extent. I mean, I took that he was able to fully satisfy them. That was a relationship that they had with him. What do people usually think about the relationship with God in the material world? They think that those who worship God have a slave mentality. Right? This says something completely different. It's that versus the slave mentality. People who somehow feel that they're not destined to anything better than to be slaves, deprived, without facility, and to work for an ungrateful master. It's a slave mentor. He's shown that the relationship with God is something completely the opposite. So it's an important aspect of the relationship. Good point. Yeah, so we'll write both of these. So, therefore it's a symptom that he loves his queens, right? Because he's serving them with all sorts of, so it shows how Krishna loves his queens. And what was your point, Becky? You're going to rescind that one?
No, I would.
You're happy with that? Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Okay. Here's another good point we can take from that. Who else can do that? So, is he showing the world how lusty he is, or is he showing that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So, here, his relationship with his queens, it does not diminish, it does not dissolve or diminish his position that he is still the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? Because that's what people think, of course, and that's the whole argument that he's lusty, he's immoral, therefore he's an ordinary human. Well, how can an ordinary human do this? So, in his relationship with the queens, he remains the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and that would show up. In verse 31, we're asked the question, what is the meaning of Vaibhava? What is the meaning of Vaibhava? Yes. We could say it's, you know, the transcendental potency of the Lord by which he expands himself. Yes, yes, it's which is a transcendental feat in itself. He manifested himself in 16,108 plenary expansions. So they're all you know, the same, full expansions. Nothing, no defects in them, not like the clones. And simultaneously entered each and every one of the palaces, so, of the queen. So that's Vaibhava potency. expanding himself, you know, that same form. So, what's that? Yeah, it's a big topic, but there are, you know, here Prabhupada does use the term Vaibhava, and in reference to him expanding himself, you know, the form of Krishna.
This is Vasudeva Krishna.
Vasudeva Krishna, yeah. Although in Dwarka sometimes Krishna appears with two hands and sometimes with four. You know, it's a big topic, it's a big subject for Bhava, Vaibhava, and yeah. So. Back to Bhava. Yeah, very. Very. Well, you know, Vaibhava is. We studied that. Did we study it in the Nectar Devotion? I don't think we did. Did we? I don't think we got to that in chapter 19, did we? No. But it is. Vaibhava is also, we call. From memory, that which you know, stimulates the love of God. So, in that sense, you know, you know, the first six cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam should stimulate, you know, that love for Krishna. You know, in that sense. Because, you know, when you're discussing about Krishna or seeing his form or, you know, seeing his devotees, there are certain things in the category of Vaibhava which stimulate love of God. So we would say that, you know, the Srimad Bhagavatam is like that. It is has a Vaibhava effect, stimulating love of God. And the next six cantos, of course, is Bhakti Vedanta, that, you know, coming to the end, of one's studies. Fully, no more doubts. The full conclusion being reached. So, what else can we see from verse 31? Even from the translation itself. Particularly about the queens. Yeah, so, you know, how does that reflect their relationship? How does verse 31 reflect upon the relationship from the queen's side that they have with Krishna? Fully devoted, yeah. They're fully absorbed. They're actually, and they're feeling separated. You know, so there's, you know, the queen's fully absorbed. And, you know, loving love with Krishna, even when he's gone. So therefore, that, you know, they miss him, and you know, they covered their faces shyly and looked about coyly. They must have understood that Krishna knew what was going on in their minds. They're probably waiting to, you know, embrace Krishna and kiss him and what have you. And Krishna probably understood that and they're a little bit coy about that. So they're fully absorbed in conjugal love for Krishna. While we're on verse 31, Krishna married 16,000 wives. Now, what general principle can be drawn from the Lord marrying the 16,000 wives? That's one of the questions. The general principle that perhaps Prabhupada makes there somewhere. Yep. Yep, so he's Yogeshvara, well, let's see. Yes, there is a nice sentence there which sums up Prabhupada says he married only 16,000 wives and entered in each and every one of the different palaces just to impress in the history of the human beings on the surface of the earth that the Lord is never equal to or less than any human being, however powerful he may be. So that's what we were saying up here, that on the previous board. Was that here? Ah, yes, yeah. Unlimited satisfies his queens. In his relationship with the queens, he remains the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that principle is being stated nicely there by Prabhupada. He is impressing in the history of human beings that the Lord is never equal to or less than any human being. Yeah. His relationship with the Queen certainly didn't diminish that. Now, looking further at the relationship, just going on with that topic of the Lord with his devotees, Let's look at this. Their feminine shyness a little closely. They're generally a woman who's away from whose husband is away from home. They don't take part in social functions, and you know, they don't decorate themselves so much. It says they should not laugh and should not go to any relative's house. A wife should never be present before herself, present herself before the husband in an unclean state. She must decorate herself with ornaments and good dress and should always be present before the husband in a happy and joyous mood. So, some of these social formalities, when Krishna entered the palace, one may think that they should have properly prepared themselves to greet their husband. When he returned. But they didn't. They actually just approached him as they were. So that, you know, it's a, because it doesn't mean a lot now these days. But if we can put ourselves in those situations, these things were unthinkable, you know, for a wife in those days. In the same way that you know, the wife may not eat before the husband. You know, it's just that these are the social customs and what have you that they did. But says they once gave up their engagements, including the vows of women as described above. So these are all different vows. They gave up the vows of how they should present themselves before their husband who had just arrived home. Here also is that they were so caught up with the idea of embracing the Lord that this thought factually made them unconscious of their surrounding environment. So, you know, that's another... this prime state of ecstasy annihilated all other formalities and social conventions, and thus they escaped all stumbling blocks on the path of meeting the Lord. So we can summarize that as a principle which describes their relationship. Anyone like to get me started? Let's summarise that as a principle.
Prema Bhakti. Overrides social customs.
Let's say the Queen's love. Right, because we have, just to make it more specific, the Queen's loves. That's what's that? Yes, but they still, you know, they didn't remove themselves from the room to go and put on, you know, in one sense they'd sort of been living quite austerely in the absence of Krishna. But then when the husband comes home, one should, a wife, according to these customs, presents herself very nicely, colourful, and saris and jewels and so many things and what have you. They didn't do that. They were just caught up in wanting to embrace the Lord just immediately. And to the point where they became a little bit oblivious of who else was present. So, they did override some of the social customs.
Feminine social
customs of that time. So the Queen's love, it really... we could say that it annihilates stumbling blocks. To meet the Lord. And I would also add, physically, I guess, or by trance. Because even when he was away, their love was so intense that they never forgot him. But it's an aspect of their relationship. This is how much love there was. Verse 32, we see that the insuperable ecstasy was so strong that the queens who were shy first embraced the Lord in the innermost recesses of their hearts, and they embraced him visually, then they sent their sons to embrace him, which is equal to personal embracing. Although they tried to restrain their feelings, they inadvertently shed tears. Really just following on the same point. That whatever stumbling blocks were there, they somehow or another overcame it. Somehow or another. They managed to meet the Lord and embrace him. As that was their heart's desire. In verse 33, although Lord Sri Krishna was constantly by their sides as well as exclusively alone, his feet appeared to them to be newer and newer. The goddess of fortune, although by nature always restless and moving, could not quit the Lord's feet. So what woman can be detached from those feet having once taken shelter of them? So, how can we sum that up in principle? So this is looking at the relationship between Krishna and his queens. The relationship was ever fresh. And there's an example there. Even the goddess of fortune, who's known as Chanchala, flickering, she cannot leave his lotus feet. How can they? What else do we learn from the verse 33 in the purport there that somehow gives us a clue about the relationship somehow or another? Thank you for your input. I put it that one we can say defeating the comment that Krishna is lusty, we say he's not lusty. And Prabhupada is pointing out in the purport that he's enjoying his own potencies. So this is this is an important point about the relationship between Krishna and the queens, is that they are, how are they related to the Lord? They are his internal potencies, and therefore if Krishna is enjoying his own internal spiritual pleasure potency, how can he be actually lusting over something else or someone else? He's only enjoying himself, and therefore he's fully self-satisfied. Sort of, you know, something you touched on before. The Lord is fully self-satisfied, and that is because, you know, he has his own internal pleasure potency, so he can just be happy without taking something from anywhere else. He's satisfied because he has his own internal pleasure potency, which manifests as his pastimes and all the personalities in his pastimes. People might say, you know, he's in one sense, you know, Krishna married 16,108 queens, but it's almost like he's gained a wife, or gained 16,000 wives. But actually, these are eternally related. They're eternally his wives. You know, they're married. His potency is eternally married to him. You say that, you know, the hand is always married to the body. You know, his internal potency is always married to him. So it's not lusty that somehow he's, you know. Text 34. What can we comment about text 34? Uh, how the Lord was pacified, you know, after the Battle of Kurukshetra. He was like the wind which causes friction between bamboos and so sparks a fire. Where does that fit in with our conversation? It's probably, it's not actually just taken up so much by Srila Prabhupada. He explains the verse. Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur, he says that in one sense, we're talking about the Lord's unimpeded love for the queens. And one way, another way to look at that is to look at him where he's in a relationship, not so much in this unimpeded love, but more in an impartial mood. And it helps to highlight the difference, how, you know, fortunate these queens are. They've got his unimpeded love, whereas in the Battle of Kurukshetra, he was present there. It was more in this impartial mood, just like the wind passing through the bamboo, causing the fire. Let me put that to you. All right. Okay. Text 35. All right. Text 35. The Supreme Personality of God is Sri Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, appeared on this planet by his internal potency and enjoyed himself among competent women as if he were engaging in mundane affairs. How does that reflect upon his relationship? In what way? What can we draw from that? Enjoyed himself amongst competent women. I'm not sure how that shows that he's, you know, it's stating that he's satisfying. As if he, well, yes, as if he were engaging in mundane affairs. So, in other words, he's appearing like a common husband. Just like Devaki, she wanted Krishna, who appeared in his forearm form, to appear like, you know, she didn't want, you know, Vishnu sitting on her lap. How will I explain this to the neighbourhood? So, is that, what did you say? He. Yeah, okay. So. Satisfy his devotees as they desired. Yep. They wanted him as their husband, and so therefore he became just like an ordinary husband of the best type. Yep. He didn't prance around the house like he was God. So, yes, that's it. What else can we say? Yes. So, yes. And that's important because it shows that he's not lusty. Right? He's reciprocating with his devotees as they desire, and he's also acting for the benefit of the conditioned souls. Nowhere is there any symptom of being lusty or immoral. Right? So, you know, again, he acts for the benefit for the conditioned souls. Not out of lust. And again, that proves his relationship is transcendental. Yeah. In the purport also, another thing that shows that his transcendental, of course, is it describes them as, you know, among competent women. And then we see in the purport, they're transcendental liberated souls, perfect manifestations of the internal energy. That's what's competent. You know, there's no mundane defects, they're transcendental. That shows also the relationship is transcendental, because there, the queens are transcendental. Transcendental liberated souls, and that makes the relationship transcendental from that point of view. So from Krishna's side, transcendental on a couple of counts. From the queen's side, transcendental. Bhagavan. Hear the word. The Lord is Param Brahma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Usually we understand the word Bhagavan refers to Param Brahma. Prabhupada makes the point there that if the living beings searching after liberation come to the point of knowing that there's no happiness in the material world, but happiness lies in Brahman, spirit, why would this Param Brahman be searching after happiness on a material platform? So again, because he's described there as Bhagavan, we know that previously Bhagavan has been described as Param Brahman in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Equals not lusting. It doesn't make sense. So the cause of the Lord's enjoyment, the desire to enjoy, and the activities of enjoyment are all beyond the material gunas. He is not material. And if we look at the relationship from any side, from the queen's side, their motivation, Krishna's motivation, their activities, none of it points to Krishna being under the influence of the material energy. Let's see. Oh, there's a few spaces there. Of course, the Purva Svajaya question of 13 was analyze the relationship between Krishna and his queens in Dwarka in verses 36 to 39. And so far, of course, so that's just a smaller part, really, of what the essay question is asking, but it's an important part. So we see in verse 36, although the queen's beautiful smiles and furtive glances were all spotless and exciting, and although they could conquer Cupid himself by making him give up his bow in frustration, although even Lord Shiva, tolerant Lord Shiva, could fall victim to them, still, despite all their magical feats and attractions, they could not agitate the senses of the Lord. So we can see that only unalloyed transcendental service can satisfy the Lord. So many different occasions, in many ways there, Krishna should have been agitated by lust, but he wasn't. There's no signs of being agitated in a mundane way. He's satisfied just with their love, their pure love. So of course we can certainly understand that the queens were able to captivate the Lord to make him reciprocate with them, so that. To some degree or another, we can say that he was agitated by their love, by their prema. But certainly there were no mundane causes to agitate his senses. In verse 37, we see the common materialistic conditioned souls speculate that the Lord is one of them. Out of their ignorance, they think that the Lord is affected by matter, although he is unattached. So, as Prabhupada points out, people like to look at one side of the picture and not the other. But we've looked at the other side. We've looked here at so many different points on two boards that show there is the relationship is transcendental. As Prabhupada points out, they don't want to look at any of this. They just want to see one thing. Oh, he's married, so many women, and he has so many girls. Oh, he must be lucky. They look at one thing. All the things we've discussed, they don't want to look at. That's what that verse is saying. Now, verse 38. This is the divinity, the personality of Godhead. He is not affected by the qualities of material nature, even though he's in contact with them. Similarly, the devotees who have taken shelter of the Lord do not become influenced by the material qualities. So, Krishna can contact the material energy and not be affected or influenced. So, the difficulty of people, they would argue that Krishna is in the material world. And because he's in the material world, although he may be God or supreme, but when he comes into the material world, he becomes affected by it. And of course, the proof of it is the fact that he becomes lusty in a bigger way than other people, because he's somehow more supreme. But because he's in the material world, he's taken a material body, and therefore he's affected by that material body, just like one of us. That's what they think. But this verse is saying, yes, he is in the material world. You can say that, because people in the material world have seen him, but he's not affected. What is the proof that he's not affected? All these things that we've looked at here. None of those points there show that in any way Krishna has been affected by the material energy. In fact, all of them show that he's not been affected. And yet he's in the material world. Verse 39. So therefore it's proving again, once again that verse is proving the Lord's relationship with the queens is completely transcendental. Why? Because even though he is manifesting that relationship in the material world for the pleasure of his devotees and for the and to help their conditioned souls, while he's here, he remains unaffected by the material qualities. Therefore, their relationship is transcendental. Verse 39. The simple and delicate woman truly thought that Lord Sri Krishna, their beloved husband, followed them and was dominated by them. They were unaware of the extent of the glories of their husband, as the atheists were unaware of him as the supreme controller. So, so of course, we can say that one of the characteristics of the relationship between Krishna and his queens, we've just heard that it's not affected by the material energy, and now we can understand that it is under the influence of the spiritual energy or yoga maya. So Krishna and the queens relationship is under yoga maya, or the spiritual potency to nourish rasa. To nourish rasa means that by forgetting that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he's playing so wonderfully the part of a husband, it nourishes their love for their husband. It doesn't, there's no crippling effect. The more they understand that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the more it actually cripples. But the point is that we can see the influence of yoga maya, or the spiritual potency, which is another way of showing that their relationship is transcendental, and therefore Krishna could not be lusty anymore. So therefore we've covered fully all the questions and what have you. essay questions. There are some essay questions, of course, we haven't quite covered, which will be covered in the when we do this last couple of chapters, 12 and 13. We've got it about 10 minutes. Let's make a few comments about the essays and some of the work. Anyone has any further comments about this? Anyone? Yep. Read the question out. It brings to point the discussion I'm going to have now about writing an essay. Some of the things that I've noticed. Yes. In one sentence? No. Well, you can do it in one sentence, but because you wouldn't do that in the essay, you wouldn't get very many marks. But you would say that you probably some of the last verses there that in Krishna's relationship with the queens, there are no signs that he was affected by the material energy, even though he's in this material world. But there's no signs that show. People say he's lusty. You know, show what, you know, present one thing that shows that he was lusty. You know, people say that he's influenced by the most material nature. And therefore he's just a lusty person. But there's nothing there that shows he's lusty or immoral. So that's the simple answer. There's just nothing that shows that he's affected by the material energy. And every time someone will present something, you can just easily defeat it with all these any of these different points. According to what someone says, it's just very easy to defeat. Now, the question. Yeah. Basically, there's five points for each. For explaining the relationship, and 5 points for effectively defeating the misunderstanding that Krishna is immoral. Question 3, 5 each.
Selecting passages,
it actually reflects Srila Prabhupada's mood and mission, which is something I want to touch on, and then for discussing the relevance of these statements in ISKCON and for society in general. That's another 5 points. All right. What's that?
Are you touching on mood and mission now? Are you touching on Prabhupada's mood and mission?
No. I just want to talk about writing an essay itself. We're just refining it. Identifying points to show understanding. So that's good. In each essay, first we have to show that we've actually understood. You know. So we have our essay showing, yes, I understand this. And that understanding is first shown that we've identified the points of that understanding. There may be, you know. If we list other points that have no relevance to that essay question, it means that we haven't understood. Right? If we can't list the points which actually relate to that question, identify them, we haven't understood it. So we have to, first of all, in the essay, make sure that we identify. There are so many things in the Bhagavatam and so many things in the purport. You've seen, we've just gone through here. You know, we've gone through paragraphs, you know, that long, and we pulled out one or two sentences. Because they're the points that identify this question that we're asked. If someone fills up their essay with everything else that's in that purport and misses that sentence that we picked out, it means they haven't understood. So they can't get the marks for understanding. They must identify the significant points. Now, in identifying them, we need to understand that we're presenting our realization according to the aims. You know, a preaching aim, personal application, you know, mood and mission, like that. So then, you know, we want to do something with that understanding. It has a benefit somewhere for us, for preaching, like that, for society. You know, so that should be there. We're quoting Sanskrit, which is significant to the points we've identified. Giving references where we can. Not everything has to have a reference, but especially quotes, you know, we should try and reference them. And we're giving an analogy. So these are things that we put in, some Sanskrit quotes, some references, some analogies. Backing up our understanding, right? Now, the points are to be connected with some consistency. You're writing something like a purport. So, it's not necessary, you know, a tabulation of points. It's an essay. It's not a table form of points, because that if it's just presented in a table form of points, it doesn't quite connect one point to the next, and that therefore that understanding may not be there with that student. So it's like a purport. There are different points in Prabhupada's purports and the verses, and he's connecting them in a little essay. Each purport is a little essay. So we're not just, you know, we certainly have, the points need to be, in one sense, significantly identified and listed, but not to the point where it's just a table of, you know.
But keeping up to the becomes hard to identify and explain.
Yep.
Still have all the
So, yeah, That's a fact. Therefore, you know, we've covered so many points here. And in your essay, you get 5 marks for, you know, identifying these, and 5 marks for proving that Krishna is not lusty. There's no way you can list all of these, and nor is anyone asking you to. For our benefit, we've gone through one. It helps us to practice identifying significant statements. That's what we've done today. And that's what more and more you need to do yourself, to be able to go through that purport of Prabhupada's, and there's a sentence, a half a sentence, you just pick that out. That's the one I'm looking for, because for this question. For other questions, I'll look for something else. That's what we've done here, and that's what we're practicing. Taking that, you don't need all of them. We've just done it nice and thoroughly. But you can take some of those, and particularly you should take some of the most important ones that are, you know, a significant theme within them. You know, you probably wouldn't take the least important point and just base your whole essay on that. No, you would try and look at what you can. And take the significant ones, which, you know, present a strong argument, you know, and then those points, they should be easily identifiable, and yet they're linked in a nice essay. You know, thoughts, one thought flowing nicely into the next, not a big jump. Oh, how do you get from there to there? So, you know, it's a flowing essay. Now, of course, it's interesting and it's pleasant to read. you see that, in other words, your presentation. Some devotees have some little stories or something that just quickly fit in there, make it interesting, and it really fits in well. They're not just filling space, and it's sort of quite unique to their essay. So, you know, things like that is good, of course. And at the same time, you know, there's a Prabhupada's statements that are significantly there. It sort of comes to a conclusion. You know, an essay sort of is making a statement. It's going in a certain direction, and it's sort of, you know, when you get to the end of it, you've been taken to the maturity of a thought or a realization or a meditation. Not necessarily that you're sort of going somewhere in the thoughts and then you zigzag back over here and then back onto this one, and when you get to the end of it, it just sort of stops nowhere. I notice in mood and mission especially that sometimes devotees miss the actual statements that reflect mood and mission. It means that they may want to look at the definition, you know, that mood and mission, Prabhupada's mood and mission means, you know, oh, this is what ISKCON's got to do. Oh, this is one of the things that ISKCON needs to do in this world. And it's, you know, we're going to, you know, eventually we need to establish a ruler like Maharaj Yudhisthira. And train, you know, and someone who's trained, as, you know, like that. Almost. But, and Prabhupada's mood could be like that. Prabhupada may say, this may be impossible, therefore chant Hare Krishna. So you see, that's the mood, right? So there's a mission statement, and then Prabhupada's mood will reflect to the extent that that can be the way, you know, sort of how it can be done in Kali Yuga, in Lord Chaitanya's movement compared to other movements, in Prabhupada's own, you know, inimitable way. So there's a mission, there's something ISKCON has got to do, ISKCON representing Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada's mood may sometimes be there as well, or sometimes Prabhupada's mood's there, not necessarily fully connected to mission statements, strong mission statements. So it can sometimes you pluck out Prabhupada's mood, his mission, both together, but we need to sort of be able to identify them properly. And I notice it is one of the weak spots sometimes in the essays. For as far as like the numbering and sectioning off the essays, very good, you know, when you're preparing an essay, because you can really just, you've got your points there. I wouldn't call that finish. I would then turn those numbered points and what have you into a nice free-flowing essay, like a purport. You know, like that. That's so it sort of keeps some of the definition. You can really see the points, and at the same time, it sort of goes into a free flow. You know, both can be there, but so not that it's an essay in such a way that I can't identify the points, nor is it like clinical points, no real essay like that. Let them both. Yeah.
Mr. Collins? Yep. I think that's the way essays are written.
Yes.
The thing is that it's pretty high level skills.
That's right, yes.
Very high level skills. It enables you to cover basic concepts, you've understood them, you understand how it works with analysis, and you're asked to make, like in social sciences, they always ask you to do that, and then you make your own individual points.
Yes.
You need to have a thorough understanding of what you need to do.
Yes.
Sometimes you just are pressed to get it done.
Yes, that's a fact. Therefore, in the marking, I actually haven't penalised anyone in the marking for any of those things. And as we're going through, I see that gradually all the essays are becoming better and better. And only if after, you know, a year or so, we look at the essays and they, some of the suggestions we mentioned 6 months ago haven't been, then we may start taking marks off. At the moment now, I'm just identifying the points and everything like that, marking accordingly. So, yeah. It is a high level skill, but it's very nice, and because those essays are of course literally a whole presentation in that. You know.
So, in reference to that, do they have to be properly edited and everything? Like, say, I'm giving an assignment to you, they would be properly edited. There'd be all the formatting, the everything. Does that?
Yes. Gradually. The better the you know the presentation. There is a couple of marks in each essay for presentation, and I haven't been deducting those couple of marks. One day, if I'm in a bad mood, I might do that. We've gone way over time. So you're ready to come in with
yes.
There you go. All right, children. let's discuss that next week. If you bring that up. Yeah.